Welcome to Credit Exchange, your weekly podcast for all things credit, where we speak to the biggest newsmakers and news shapers in finance. Hello, I'm your host, Lisa Lee. Today I have with me Dan Pietrzak, KKR's Global Head of Private Credit. KKR has become a credit powerhouse with nearly $250 billion in credit AUM and more than $100 billion of private credit AUM alone. Today, Dan and I are going to speak about the changing market. A few months into President Trump's presidency, we have now have an onset of volatility and credit spreads are widening. Welcome, Dan.
Well, thank you, Lisa. Great to be with you.
So can we discuss the past 8 weeks? How has the Trump presidency and financial markets panned out for you? How do you make of this moment?
It's a fair question. Clearly, there's more volatility in the world today than there was that 8 weeks ago or when the election sort of was completed in November. I'd say a couple of things. Number one, I think we've always had a view that volatility will be persistent, you know, meaning you might have a quarter a year or a quarter every sort of other year. You just have a different kind of financial market today than you did 10, 15 years ago. You have banks holding less inventory, providing sort of consistent trading capital. You know, there's a fair amount of geopolitical things sort of out there. So I don't think we're surprised by the concept of volatility being there. You know, I think we are probably a little surprised to, you know, what we've seen in the beginning of the year, right? I think the world was kind of coming around to the idea of a Trump presidency being arguably pro-business, pro-deal, sort of anti-regulatory in some way. I mean, those could still very well be the goals, but I think the market has been, you know, very focused on the tariff conversations. You know, I think the market always wants some level of certainty, which it never really gets, but there's just been a lot of back and forth for the countries impacted, the size of those tariffs, sort of, et cetera. So, you know, definitely sitting in a more, you know, I think bumpy road today than we would have guessed on Jan 1. You know, the other side of that, though, I think the economy still remains in pretty good shape. So it's a question of probably getting to the other side.
You're doing private credit. How does one invest in private credit or think through private credit in a period of volatility like this?
In some ways, these types of markets or when there is volatility is when private credit should be able to shine, right? If you think about, you know, what we're doing, right? And you mentioned this, I mean, our private credit business, you know, north of $100 billion, you know, really focused on two areas, right? One is we lend money to corporates, you know, up and down the capital structure. You know, the other being our asset-based finance business where we are buyers or lenders against portfolios of financial and sort of hard assets. So, you know, we have long-dated tied-up capital. Obviously, we're thoughtful or mindful about kind of mark-to-market risk on the portfolio, but we're long-term investors, right? We care about the ultimate sort of outcomes. I think we are starting to see a couple of places where we can step in, maybe get terms and conditions or pricing that maybe didn't exist, you know, a handful of weeks ago. I'm not bothered by the volatility. I wouldn't say that I'm cheering it on, but those usually are, you know, good tailwinds for a business like this. I'm probably more focused on what the impact could be in more the medium term. Does this trigger some type of recessionary concern? Does it impact the consumer and their related spending? You know, those types of factors.
Earlier in the year, maybe even before the presidency, there was a sense that maybe President Trump's tariff thinking was more of a negotiation ploy. But now it definitely feels as though tariffs are going to be implemented. And it's difficult to figure out exactly in what way, in what manner, and how much. So when you're investing, how do you account for tariffs that may or may not come to play? And when you look at corporates and lending?
Fair question. I would say maybe two things to the initial sort of part of that. I think we always were under the assumption that some level of tariffs would be sort of passed through. I think it's now about the quantum of those maybe surprising, you know, to the larger amount or the larger size. And I would agree with you. I think I would have had the view, you know, either personally or I think the markets have had the view that some of it was probably a negotiating tool as well. For some of these things, you know, I think we were trying to get ahead of it. What I mean by that is, you know, in a pretty detailed manner, you know, we're scrubbing the portfolio Q3, Q4 last year. Right, thinking about names that could be impacted by tariffs, you know, names that could be impacted when, you know, DOGE was announced and what that could mean, you know, for the revenue side of things. You know, I think on the direct lending business, maybe kind of start there. You know, I think we are trying to lend to businesses that we don't believe, you know, will have a lot of cyclicality or have, quite frankly, maybe a bunch of levers to pull if sort of something does go wrong. So I think we can incorporate that in the underwriting. The thing that's probably been on my mind more is the impact to the existing portfolio. But I think the work we've done makes us feel like we're in a pretty good spot there, but it's something we've got to keep our eye on. And I think it's not just tariffs. I think it's things like DOGE as well.
Because direct lending, the loans don't trade. I mean, there's maybe one-off idiosyncratic trades, but for the most part, you can't trade out of names, add in names. So what kind of work do you do?
That's the way we underwrite it, right? We're assuming that we are, you know, holding these loans until we get repaid or it matures. There is a bit of liquidity out there. I think that liquidity is more maybe increasing or decreasing your size in loans that you're, you know, already in versus, you know, a broad sort of trading environment. I don't expect that to ever actually make its way into this marketplace. I think we do have the ability on these deals to, you know, be closer to management. We've usually or generally met them and have spent time with them either before the deal or sort of right after. You know, there is increased reporting in these transactions. You know, we do have the benefit of, you know, a 20-person portfolio monitoring unit, that's what we call it, who has no kind of new deal responsibility, but is a tremendously valuable part of the investment team. They are in charge of helping drive, you know, the quarterly review process. We do have a dedicated, you know, workout and governance team who's not just there for, you know, something all the way there in kind of a workout sort of point, but the woman who runs that sort of team is on the investment committee, so she's there up front. You know, her and one of our other senior members of the team are responsible for the full, you know, quarterly portfolio review process. So we can be, I think, pretty granular in that review. I think, Lisa, to your point, though, I mean, it is an illiquid loan, right? So the biggest and most important decisions, you know, we're making are up front. I do think direct lending has an advantage of, you know, usually having the ability to get back to the table a couple of times to help yourself de-risk. But, you know, that decision up front is important. But I also think it's quite important to be actively managing your existing portfolio.
So talking about new lending, when you look at tariffs, DOGE, weakening consumer sentiment, and possibly now even the R word, recession, what sectors are you drawn to and what sectors are you like more leery of right now?
Well, I just going back to the maybe the initial point of that, I mean, I think the impact of the tariff conversation or some of the volatility out there is actually not the M&A volumes that, you know, maybe the market was expecting, right? So our teams, you know, as we sit here at the end of March, are busier, I think, than they've been, you know, throughout probably all of 22, 23, 24. But it's probably not as busy as I would have guessed if you asked me on, you know, November 10th. I think the knock-on effect is just a little bit of this kind of wait-and-see approach before maybe some of these sales processes kick off. I don't think that the thematic or the thesis has changed, though, right? I mean, we're on the direct lending side, we're trying to build an origination funnel that's as broad as possible, right? We're covering, you know, more than a couple hundred sponsors globally. We've got a fairly active non-sponsor effort. You know, we are, you know, up and down kind of the size spectrum of EBITDA. We're not in that lower middle market space, but we're prepared to go down, you know, to $25 million. You know, the sweet spot's probably more, you know, that 50 to 150 of sort of EBITDA. So I think we're picking and choosing a little bit by size. I think history has told us that these, you know, larger companies almost by definition probably have a better CEO, CFO, probably have less customer or supplier concentration. You know, just at the end of the day, more levers to pull if something does go wrong. So I don't think that, you know, kind of piece of the puzzle's changed. You know, we're not lending against kind of, we'll call it the broad index of names out there, right? We're excluding sectors from just our general portfolio that we would perceive to be, you know, overly cyclical or potentially sort of risky, right? So we've been staying away from the consumer on the direct lending side. We've been staying away from, you know, consumer discretionary. You know, energy credit, in my mind, is not an area that you're supposed to spend time on in an illiquid format. Right. If you want to be there, you can, you know, be involved in the high yield bond sector, sort of own the equity where you actually have the upside. So I don't think it's necessarily changed the spaces. It's probably created risk factors for certain deals that might, you know, warrant either us passing or, you know, warrant, you know, additional structure in these deals. And this is not entirely dissimilar than, you know, the conversations we may have had in the last couple of years around AI. Right. There's names that we're pretty darn comfortable with from a lending perspective. You know, as the AI revolution sort of advanced, probably more cautious. We've actually, you know, exited some of those names. I'm not sure there's necessarily any significant, you know, short-term impacts to them, but I think more medium or near or medium or longer term there are, which could impact value, which could impact our loan. Right. So I think you have to be dynamic and adjust your underwriting to what's happening in the market.
Sounds like you're being more selective.
Yeah, I think we are. In every direct lender's, you know, investment deck, there's these, you know, one slide that shows about investment sourcing and all the deals you looked at and all the deals that you sort of passed on to a low sort of hit rate. You know, my honest view is it doesn't matter if we do, you know, 3% of the deals or 9% of the deals we do, right? It's about having that origination funnel that you're kind of seeing what you need to see. You know, I think the larger platforms like us have had a real tailwind or benefit from this idea of being an incumbent lender, right? There's a lot of deals that we have financed either immediately prior or we're growing, you know, with that company today, or maybe we financed them in a different part of our credit business. You know, I think we're positively selecting ourselves on origination there. And those are names we're, I think, pretty prepared to lean into.
So M&A hasn't been as robust as people had hoped, expected so far this year. What about taking market share away from the leveraged loan market? I know right now at the moment, it is that there hasn't been that much weakness, but it is weakening. And when there's volatility, sponsors have opted to go to direct lending because sometimes banks also themselves can't underwrite as well, or they ask for terms that are very tight or too loose for sponsors. Are you expecting to see that kind of deal origination, or is that not at this level?
But you're probably a little bit early into the volatility to see that, right? I do think there's been this, you know, idea out there that it was kind of the syndicated loan market versus the direct lending market. And it was almost a kind of a fight to the death there. You know, we haven't really had that view, right? We have always expected these markets to coexist. There are times where the syndicated loan market, because of volatility or otherwise, could be shut and direct lending could be the only game in town. I think there are certain situations that warrant the direct lending solution versus a syndicated solution. You know, an example of that could be a carve out where the company couldn't get rated. An example of that could be a company that's expecting a meaningful amount of growth and they want access to committed capital. I think we also have seen over the last handful of years, you know, more and more sponsors getting comfortable with the direct lending product. Right. So they've just been willing to go more into the private market than the public market. I think it's always been there from a use case as like a certainty of execution. I think there's been more comfort in kind of knowing sort of your lender. You know, that being said, I think the syndicated loan markets was off to a very good start, you know, for this year. I don't expect, you know, significant credit deterioration from what's going on. I think this is probably just a little bit more of a blip of sort of market volatility, but I think the next, you know, handful of weeks and months will tell us that.
And so far we've discussed mostly direct lending, which is sub-investment grade, leveraged loans, mostly sponsored deals. Can we talk about some of what I think you and many others are very excited about, which is IG private credit, the ABS market?
I think for many years, the word private credit was probably, you know, used interchangeably with direct lending. Thinking back, you know, 2, 3, 4 years ago, I think a lot of even institutional LPs who were coming in to talk about private credit, really what they wanted to talk about was direct lending. You know, I think we've been on a bit of a journey to try to explain how direct lending is one part of private credit, but private credit's actually much broader. I think the couple pieces of that, you know, one is the asset-based finance space. Right. You know, that's a place that we've been, you know, very active. More than half of our private credit AUM comes from there. We've got a 50-person sort of dedicated team. You know, there are different parts of that market. You know, there are the parts of that market where you are probably thinking about it from more of an opportunistic type sense or a higher returning type sense. You know, there we're generally buying, you know, loan portfolios using the bank markets or the capital markets to finance it, but trying to earn, you know, double digit type returns. We've seen a lot of activity there in recent years in more of that IG space. So this is, you know, really comping out to, you know, can you earn 150 or 200 basis points wide of a similarly rated corporate credit IG bond? You know, that's been an area that's been in clear focus from insurance companies. You know, there's obviously other parts of the corporate capital structure that fall into the same definition of privately originated, privately negotiated loans. Right. So I think we've been active there in different parts of the capital structure for the corporate. And then this private IG space, you know, that is more focused on, you know, corporate situations. They're generally centered around some type of, you know, larger CapEx or situational type need. But I think there are, you know, larger pools of capital out there who are prepared to be these kind of buy and hold investors, don't need liquidity, which is generally what comes with the corporate IG bond market. And, you know, people like us have the ability to speak for size there. So, you know, definitely an area that we're spending time on. And I think, you know, spending time on probably that broad IG part of the market, both on the corporate side, but also on the asset-backed side.
Would it be safe to say that you expect faster, higher growth in this part of the market, in this part of private credit?
It probably depends a little bit how you describe the word sort of growth. I do think the use cases have the ability to continue to go up. There are a bunch of thematics out there that are requiring large CapEx dollars. That could sort of be one thematic. I do think the non-bank lender community will continue to grow. They could be, you know, users of that sort of capital base. I think one of the areas where the growth will probably get captured or at least be able to be reported is I do think there is additional investor interest in the space, right? So what I was referring to just before was more on kind of the deal side. You know, a lot of those deals might already sort of be there. They just haven't sort of come to this market yet. But I do think we've seen, as I said before, you know, more insurance companies excited about or sort of looking for that yield pickup. We've seen corporate pension plans, you know, with them being essentially in an overfunded status now, looking to de-risk their asset allocation away from equities, looking to go into credit. This is a way to pick up some additional yield when you think about sort of credit investing. We are definitely spending a lot more time with investors in that part of the market, which is somewhat consistent with, I tell you, we're spending a lot more time with investors in the asset-backed space. Right? People have been wanting to increase their private credit allocations. They've been wanting to do that in a manner that provides a certain amount of diversification versus just direct lending. So I think this investor interest in private credit continues to grow, and I think that's going to continue.
Now, you're also the global head, so I'm going to move away us away from the U.S. into Europe. And I find it really striking that in the past few weeks, the narrative has almost seemed to switch between the U.S. and Europe. U.S. was the exceptional economy expecting to grow. Europe was stagnating and wasn't investing enough. And now there's excitement about Germany spending on defense, on infrastructure, a sense that there is going to be growth and at least capital spending again. Tell me your thoughts on Europe.
It's a pretty fair point. I think I've been in London three times, you know, since the election. So once last year, once in January, and once, you know, just recently. I did sense the tone very different, right? You know, in November and even in early January, it was definitely a view that, you know, the U.S. was the exciting sort of growth place and Europe was sort of struggling. You know, I think the European piece was, you know, not just some overhang from, you know, Brexit in the U.K., but the concerns that you mentioned about Germany, which was arguably, you know, has been for the last, you know, 20 years, the engine of sort of Europe from a growth perspective. In my most recent trip there, I think you hit it spot on. Like, it almost has sort of turned on its head. You know, I think you can see that the markets get excited about government spending and what that can mean in terms of, you know, activity, and think about the multiplier effect of that and what that can mean for sort of economic growth. I think we've probably always been more constructive on the UK than what the market has been, you know, the last handful of years. You know, this is probably, you know, not a bad fact for Europe, right? I don't think you could have a very strong kind of, think about pan-Europe, strong view of on the medium-term side for Europe if Germany was going to sort of be struggling. It does feel quite positive, even though with the noise that, you know, Europe has had for the year or two sort of plus prior, we've been active there, right? Our European footprint is effectively, from a setup perspective, identical to the U.S. You know, we're active across markets there, across, you know, the entire sort of credit space. I think we've, you know, been happy with what we've seen in Europe. I mean, low growth is not a bad thing for a credit investor, right? In some ways, you could argue it removes some of the froth, so it could be more positive than a big sort of high growth sort of environment. But, you know, I think across our whole credit business, across our whole private credit business, we've been active in Europe, and I think that will continue. Maybe just a bit of a different macroeconomic backdrop now.
But given the changed macroeconomic backdrop with tariffs coming on from the U.S. and reciprocity, where are you investing in Europe right now? What sectors, what countries, what regions?
Yeah, I mean, we've always probably been more focused on Western Europe. So I'd use that as sort of a starting point. The direct lending business, I think the thematic is the same there, right? Trying to avoid, you know, what I call those cyclical sort of industries. You know, I do think the average size of the company in Europe almost by definition is smaller. I think we've seen a lot of good deal flow on the junior debt side of the equation for some of these family-owned businesses that are either looking for capital for growth or looking for the next stages of either family ownership or maybe gearing up for a sale. You know, we've been pretty active with the banks in Europe on the asset-based finance side. I think that's been across, you know, providing some solutions for them as it relates to, you know, SRTs. We've been involved, you know, involved in kind of buying assets from the banks. You know, I think the banking system, you know, broadly has been a little bit more thoughtful of what I would say their own, you know, either asset allocation or kind of leaning into what works for them, but leaning out for sort of what doesn't, right? And we can come in and you know, we're in the asset sort of ownership business and the asset back business for us, right? So it lines up really well for us to partner with banks. We view banks as pretty big and important partners for our asset-based finance business.
Probably the area of private credit that I think has the most growth potential because the base is so small is Asia. And I know you guys have made big steps there. Explain to us a little bit of the struggles in Asia and the potential there if you could actually get up past some of those.
I think we'd agree with you in terms of the growth potential. You know, we have a fully staffed credit business there. You know, again, in many ways, it looks a lot like we have in Europe or, you know, what looks like we have in the U.S. You know, I think if you do take, you know, maybe a step back, I think we saw the really the starts and the growth of the private credit business in the U.S. I think we would have seen, you know, Europe kind of 5 to 10 years behind that. And I think you'd say the same thing about Asia, sort of 5 to 10 years behind Europe. You know, I think how does that happen? I think you continue to see, you know, maybe banks kind of optimizing their balance sheet so they become less sort of holders of risk. You get some growing sort of capital markets. So you get just more deal activity. You get larger or more active, or in the case of Asia, maybe just more, you know, dedicated private equity businesses who, you know, the banks, you know, aren't really in the business of trying to finance them and sort of hold that risk. And folks like us can come in and sort of fill the void. We've been pretty happy with what we've seen there in terms of, you know, deal flow. You know, we as a firm have been active in Asia for some time, so we've been able to leverage the footprint that we have there. You know, it's really started out of our private equity business. It is, in my mind, a local market, so we can have people on the ground in these various geographies. The direct lending activity for us there is probably centered around Australia. You think about where decent sponsor activity has been. You think about, you know, rule of law. The rest of Asia, and arguably Australia is sort of different, but the rest of Asia, you know, probably, you know, maybe more active in different sort of parts of our investing businesses. But, you know, spot on, we're bought into the forward growth there, not just from the points I've talked about, but just think about demographics. So we'll continue to grow that business and be active there.
Now, since you are a dyed-in-the-wool credit person, we're going to talk a little bit about the downside. With all the volatility and some of the geopolitical issues, the macroeconomic issues, does this change your expectation on defaults and also on recoveries? I think those two are almost go hand in hand.
I think you're right. I mean, credit is a business that, you know, has to be focused on downside protection, right? You need to be right 95 or, you know, 98% of the time. When you do get it wrong, you are banking on or focused on getting a fairly sort of high recovery rate. I think the starting point going into this year, you know, we still have seen what I would say would be revenue and EBITDA growth across the portfolio. You know, in our asset-backed business, we've still seen very strong performance out of the consumer, albeit probably weaker performance out of the, you know, the lower FICO, but very strong performance out of the higher FICO. You know, a lot of recessions could be caused from things like an asset bubble, i.e. a housing crisis, right? We just don't see that, right? The U.S. is arguably structurally short houses. You know, there was nowhere near the speculation in the market that you would have seen in advance of the financial crisis. So I think the starting point was pretty good. When you think about default specifically, I think what is on our mind is interest coverage ratios because of the rate environment, you know, are down across the board. I think that does mean when a company hits a bump in the road or has a challenge, you know, the issue pops up to the surface kind of faster. So we've expected a, you know, a higher default environment than we've seen in the last handful of years. Now, arguably, that's been artificially low. You know, maybe your starting point sort of off. You know, I think we've seen on the situations that have had some challenges for us, we've seen some pretty good things from either sponsor support or kind of ultimate recovery rates. But, you know, I think if this volatility does persist, if this volatility does push things into a recessionary sort of, you know, landscape, which is not our sort of call, you know, maybe those higher default expectations can even expand, but I don't think we're necessarily seeing that today, but we're watching it, right? With rates where they are, the lack of free cash flow must answer to corporate. I think your spidey senses have to be up when there is a challenge, you need to be kind of dealing with it, you know, quickly.
Now pick payment in kind where you pay through with more debt. That has been in the headline quite a bit as a worry for private credit. Are you worried about PIK and the growing usage of that, or do you think that's overblown?
I think you got to probably break it down in a couple of pieces, right? So one, from just a general matter, we'd rather get paid cash than PIK in every instance. PIK has historically been more of a concept for junior debt instruments. You know, what we have seen come into the market is, you know, essentially a PIK toggle feature on, you know, a fair amount of direct lending loans. You know, I think when you do pull the onion away a little bit on that, though, that doesn't bother me that much. I mean, I don't love it, to be blunt. But if you think about it, the general rules of the road for that is they have the borrower would have the ability to PIK, you know, let's call it, you know, 40% of the spread. So not 40% of the total yield, 40% of the spread. And they're, you know, generally able to do that, you know, for only, you know, a limited amount of time. So let's call it 24 months. Right. So if you think about just the math of that, in the environment we're in where spreads are pretty tight, if the regular rate direct lending loan is 500 basis points over, you know, that means they can PIK 2% a year for 2 years. Right. So that's 4%. You're having a modest increase to your LTV, but arguably not sort of horrific that we, you know, would force to go back to cash pay. So it's on our mind, you know, that piece of it for sure. But I don't think it ends up being really that big of an issue because of the guardrails. And also, ironically, a fraction, like I think less than 25% of the loans we've done that have the PIK toggle feature are actually using it today.
Oh, that's interesting. They actually don't use it. They like having the option, yeah. But it's not something that's utilized.
Yeah.
Now, Dan, I've hit on defaults and recoveries and also these PIKs as possible worries. But you tell me, what is your worry? What is your big worry that you worry about at night and you're going to the office and you have in your head?
It's probably a longer list than the time we have for the question. You know, I do think the lack of M&A has been a worry because it, you know, there has been a, you know, a fair amount of capital raised. I think there's people, the market's, you know, sort of chasing deals. You know, I do think direct lending does fall kind of in the bands, right? You know, this is a downside protected product. I think you're always making a loan with a view that, you know, you have an expectation it will not default, but you'd also have an expectation if it did default, you'd be well positioned from a recovery perspective. So the band is more kind of borrower friendly and lender friendly, right? 22 and 23 was very lender friendly. Today, sort of borrower friendly, but it's within those bands, right? That said, for the longer it persists, you know, maybe the more borrower friendly things can get. So that's kind of a worry. I'm not concerned about the volatility, right? As I said, I think the volatility is potentially a tailwind for private credit sort of generally. I am worried about the impact, though, of what caused that volatility, right? Can there be that surprising economic downturn that people, you know, might not have been sort of counting on? Obviously, these businesses would be highly correlated to recessions. I think we're well-equipped and well-staffed to get through that, but, you know, that's kind of on my mind. The market is banking on the U.S. consumer remaining strong, right? If that pivots or that changes, right, I think that could, you know, sort of alter sort of the outlook. So there's a list of things that I think that have to be in your mind. You know, I do think that the general market reports out there, you know, outside of the last handful of weeks have generally been about the, we'll call it overly strong sort of economic backdrop. You know, being a lender or being an investor in, you know, private credit or a liquid credit, you know, I think there's some risk factors out there that you need to be mindful about. And, you know, I think most of the, you know, larger players out there, including ourselves, are well equipped to manage through that. But I think there's more out there than maybe in the media sort of day in and day out.
So I hate to leave on a down note. So I'm going to ask you a positive question. You look at US, Europe, Asia, throughout the globe and all the different sectors and the different asset classes that make up now private credit. What's your best trade? What do you, if you had just to tell someone, your neighbor or your best client, this is where you want to be?
Yeah, it's a fair question and one that we, you know, would get a fair, you know, from various investors or consultants. I'm going to answer it a little bit of a different way, right? I do think, you know, today, you know, the asset-backed business and what we're seeing in junior debt or capital solutions has been pretty interesting, right? And I think it's been interesting because you've seen probably this borrower-friendly environment in direct lending. So I think that's where, in concept, you'd sort of be leaning into. I do think, though, the direct lending market's been difficult to ignore, right? Because on an unlevered basis, you're still earning almost 10%. That's a couple hundred basis points wide of where people were, you know, what they would have been earning in January of, say, 22. And if you think about most of the portfolios or the pools of capital out there in direct lending, they're levered, right? So, you know, while spreads have gone down in direct lending, credit spreads have gone down across the board, right? So those leverage facilities are also, you know, much more efficient. So honestly, the levered returns haven't sort of changed that much. So the more interesting parts, or maybe the places we've been leaning into, have been, you know, that asset-based finance effort or up and down the capital structure on the corporate side. But I do think from a total return perspective, direct lending remains hard to ignore.
Yes, it is an attractive appeal. So that's your call. This has been great. Thank you so much, Dan, for being on.
I really appreciate you having me on, and thank you.
To our audience, this has been your host, Lisa Lee. Thank you for joining us and tune in next week for more on the credit market. And do follow the Credit Exchange on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you and goodbye.